once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, on this Saturday, April 4th, with the Personal Wealth Coach Second Hour, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. And this is an exciting radio show, and it's exciting because we don't know what we're going to say until we say it, and sometimes we wish we hadn't.
I wish you hadn't said that.
It's probably true. Anyway, telephone numbers to call in here if you'd like to give us some stimulating questions or comments. 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400.
And we had our exactly 100% of our callers last hour ask us the question. All the callers of the last hour ask us the same question.
Right. Yeah. It was
what
very efficient.
What about the Iranian nuclear? And we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, please. I own about 1,500 shares of Exxon. It's about one-third of my portfolio. Is that about okay still, or get rid of it? It's a sentimental. It was a gift. So I know you're not supposed to get attached.
Well,
but
let me just put it this way. Exactly how much does Exxon as a corporation love you personally?
Well, probably none.
So there is a kind of a rule in emotional relationships. If you love someone deeply who doesn't even know you exist, that's unhealthy.
Yeah.
And very frankly, there is a rule in investments that works the same way, and that is that if you hold that Exxon because of your affection for Exxon, but you don't care how much money you lose or make, sure, hold that Exxon because it makes you feel good. Whatever it's worth to you, I mean, whatever the price is, it's like having something you could sell for that price that you have sitting in your living room because you really, really love it. Now, if you're a multibillionaire and you can have, what did you say, 1,300 shares?
Yes.
Okay, and you had 1,300 shares of Exxon, or you had a work of art that was worth the same as 1,300 shares of Exxon, and you had it in your living room, and you keep it because you love it, even though you could sell it for however much.
$110,000.
$110,000. But you keep it because you just like it. You like that piece of art, you know? The funny thing is, your Exxon stock isn't even a piece of art.
Yeah, and this is,
nobody is going to come in and say, ooh, that's a beautiful Exxon 1,300 share certificate you have up there on the wall.
We're going to be the last to say that Exxon is a bad company. It's a good company. However, when you have a third of your retirement wrapped up in a company, it doesn't matter how good that company is. Something could go wrong.
Okay, so just percentage-wise, what would you say?
No.
We don't recommend going with a individual stocks as any kind of a large percentage in any way of your portfolio. We prefer diversification.
The key,
far more.
The key to limiting risk in an investment portfolio, if you could only do one thing, and believe me, most people don't know the definition of diversification in securities, but be well diversified. And the reason Jake pointed it out,
it doesn't get rid of all the risk, but it limits a lot of it.
Monday morning, there could be an announcement that Exxon was cooking the books, and they really have been losing money. And I'm not going to say
no,
this
it
is
was
even
an Exxon cookbook.
It was an Exxon cookbook. That's it. Okay. Well, no, they cooked the books, and you could have a sudden. This happened, and people say, "Well, how could a company like Exxon possibly?"
Enron did it.
You know, and everybody thought Enron was a very healthy company. It was good, trading energy, and it was doing very, very well until
based in the same city.
Yeah, and they were, and the whole issue is nobody knew they were bad until they were bad, and once they were bad, trying to sell was a really bad idea.
Right, and right now we have hindsight as 2020. People mention Enron, and it's hard to even remember that they were a respected company
at one point. Yeah. Okay, one more question. I have a future son-in-law who's taken an economics class. The first page is a picture of Mr. Obama, and it calls him the economist-in-chief. And one of the premises of the book is whether to spend money with government or private enterprise. And if you were going to write the only economics book that your kid ever saw because he's not an economics major.
Mm-hmm.
Would you do that, or would I would, it off?
You
tell me what you would put in your economics 101 book.
At the beginning of the book, I would say that that is currently one of the big questions, and that's it. It was a question in there. That's what you said, you know, and is a big question, and it is one that
My concern is calling him the economist in chief, because if you have kids who were 12 when he took over an office and are now 18,
right?
This is, I mean, where in the Constitution does it give him the right to be the economist in chief?
Well,
that's my problem.
The textbook is not the fact is that the president was never intended by the founders to be the economist in chief, but but two presidents in a row have had to assume that duty. Whether they liked it or not.
Right. And let's rewind a little bit. Let's go back in time a little bit. We'll go back.
I'm going to listen off here.
Okay.
Let's go back in time to, it's not even that far back, although if you're 16 years old, it's a long time back.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to George H.W. Bush. He took over after his boss it was no longer in charge. Ronald Reagan stepped down at the end of his term. George H.W. Bush stepped up. He won the election. He reappointed Alan Greenspan. Ronald Reagan had appointed him. Alan Greenspan's job was very clear. It's a non-political role to protect the currency of the United States against inflation and deflation and to try to keep some stabilization going as far as the...
He's given two tasks
right.
for the act.
To keep some stabilization going as far as the recessions and go ahead.
Maximum possible employment and the value of the dollar.
Right. So in the middle of that, George H.W. Bush is coming to the end of his first term. He is up for election. He is running against Bill Clinton. Alan Greenspan, in order to keep his mandate in order to look at unemployment figures and to make sure that the inflation and deflation, the value of the currency, aren't affected. Now, there's a third mandate that's been added to that, but we'll get to that another time. Decided to basically put the United States into a recession to keep inflation from going too high and to make sure that we had good employment. Now, it sounds weird. It's a little bit complicated, but Bill Clinton won the election based on it's the economy, stupid.
Mm-hmm.
When the American people elect a president based on something, and it's so common for the president to be blamed or be given credit for the economy, the reality is that throughout our history, the president hasn't been in charge of that. That hasn't been the president's role. But they get the credit or they get the blame. And now what we have is two presidents in a row that have worked really hard using their own political capital to put stimulus or change taxes based on the economy.
Jake and I listened a few years ago to President George W. Bush, who in 2008 had to make a really hard decision. You may recall that the president and the secretary of the treasury submitted a bill to Congress, which was one page long.
Three pages long. The original TARP bill.
It got extended to a few more pages. But basically, Congress gave the president some emergency money.
Well, the second time it went to pass, it was like 800 pages long because it had the alternative minimum tax thrown on top of it.
But
the
whole point
was still 3 pages.
The idea was they handed over to the President of the United States a great deal of money and said
$800 billion.
Do whatever you need to do with it. In essence, and I mean this is way oversimplified, but basically it said do whatever you need to do with this money to keep the total economy from crashing and the entire – with all of the ramifications that are associated with that. And as a result, both Presidents Bush and Obama leveraged that money tremendously, and I'll give you an example. President Bush had to make a quick decision at one point. The Hartford, an insurance company, one of the major insurance companies in the United States, it's now been determined to be systemically significant in the economy of the United States. Had it gone down, would it basically pulled the rest of the life insurance companies down with it and possibly the entire rest of the world economy? Remember that AIG, they actually went and bought AIG.
That was the beginning.
But you know, they
it's because the Federal Reserve that did that.
Well, actually, the TARP money enabled the Federal Reserve to do it because it had to become – in each case when these insurance companies are bought, and this happened with the Hartford on over a weekend because that's what George W. was talking about when I was listening to him. And what he had to do is he had to loan the money to an insurance company to buy a small bank from the FDIC that had been closed on Friday.
Yeah.
So that on a weekend, so that the insurance company could become a bank holding company, so that the Federal Reserve could go in and buy its loan it money. Now, in the case of AIG, the federal government simply stepped in and bought the shares of the company massively. And they had to.
Reserve did that.
The Federal Reserve bought them. I thought the
GM was bought by the federal government.
Okay. Anyway, so you've got the President of the United States making decisions to buy companies on the open market
based on
the total U.S. the effect that company's failure would have on the total economy of the United States. No economist in the history of the world has ever had that power or that responsibility before. And we've had two presidents from two different parties who have had to assume literally, it was almost like a case of war. It was a national emergency, and one person ultimately was saddled with the responsibility of keeping the economy of the United States, and by that, the economy of the world, from collapsing into a depression. And I want to tell you, all mistakes aside, and I'm going to not be real popular in saying this, the two of them probably, and I think in retrospect now, you should be able to say, had made some very, very good decisions. They weren't perfect because we didn't have perfect information, and no one had ever done this before. But they prevented, I think it's a universal, universally any respected economist will say that these two presidents had almost identical policies, and they prevented a Great Depression and probable World War from occurring by acting as economists. So I don't think it's at all unfair to say
now,
the president has been saddled with the responsibility of being
they asked for the
chief.
Saddle.
Yeah.
They asked for the saddle.
Oh, yeah.
And this is something also important. You brought up the Constitution. Congress is allowed to spend money as they see fit. They're allowed to, as long as it doesn't violate any of the rights that were set forth in the Constitution of the American people, they're allowed to spend that money that they collect. They're allowed to collect it as they see fit, and they're allowed to spend it as they see fit. Congress, over the years, has bequeathed a lot of its power to the executive branch when it comes to spending of money.
Mm-hmm.
The whole debt ceiling is about that. Basically, they got tired of tying a whole funding bill to a spending bill. They got tired of saying, we authorize this number of bonds to be issued to pay for this spending. So they went to the U.S. Treasury and they just said, you go ahead and issue as many bonds as you need to pay for the stuff that we've given you, and just remind us when it's time for us to raise the debt ceiling. They gave the executive branch the right to borrow money. They then, with TARP, gave the executive branch the right to spend money as they saw fit. Congress's big purview as a check and balance is to control the purse strings. They're the ones that control the money. If the president goes to war and the Congress decides not to pay for it, it's not going to work very well.
And Congress at any point,
they could pass another law and take it all back.
Right. And this is the point. No, this is one of those things that makes me a little frustrated. If the House of Representatives really wanted to take responsibility for the economic well-being of the United States,
they should have been the ones in charge of TARP.
Yeah, all they would have to do, and we had Republican control at that point, but all they would have to do at this point even is say, okay, what we're going to do is pass this bill, and we are going to determine how many Treasury bills, bonds, and notes get issued each year, and we're going to vote on it each year. And you notice that they won't touch that one with a 10-foot pole.
That's what they used to do, but it took up half of their time. For every bill that they passed, they had to pass another bill to fund that bill.
They wouldn't be able to argue about things like whether or not to write letters to Iran.
Or they wouldn't be able to argue about whether or not the debt ceiling should be raised. They're the ones that gave that power to the executive branch. Mm-hmm. If they don't want the executive branch to spend, then they shouldn't pass the spending bill.
Right.
That's there's a dysfunctional part of our government that's always in existence.
That's one of those things that Ted Cruz promised to repeal all the executive orders.
Oh, yeah.
Most of those executive orders are not most. As far as I can tell, all of the executive orders that President Obama has issued are issued under the auspices of a law passed by Congress telling him to take control, authority, and responsibility for something.
Yeah.
And you know,
That's the only way that the executive orders have power when it comes to spending, is if the Congress has already bequeathed that power to the president.
Yeah, and including, you know, and this is
unless it's
things.
A state of war.
Yeah, unless, now if you dig
then
in,
we have a different situation in a state of war. We're not in a state of war.
And that's one of those things that's ironic. If you dig down beyond the rhetoric and the speeches out there, you get to hear this. The president of the United States became the economist-in-chief the same way he's commander-in-chief. The president of the United States does not have the right to declare war. He doesn't have the right to set the budget for the military. But when it comes to executing, the Congress has delegated because of the
executive branch. They execute.
The issue of very sudden emergencies occurring, there is a lot of that gets delegated to the president by the Congress, has been delegated by the Congress. And let me tell you, it's appropriate that it be delegated by the Congress, because what you don't want, just like the Federal Reserve isn't in the Constitution, what you don't want is the political motivations
getting elected every 2 years,
538, I think it is, members of Congress determining monetary policy in the United States. You don't want them determining which companies get funded and which banks get bought,
right?
Because they can't take action over a weekend.
We laugh about this on when we look at Europe. Their central bank, the head of their central bank, changes every year. You can't make any long-term monetary policy with that short a time frame. And the first central bank, the very first central organized bank of a government, was the Bank of England. And an academic was appointed as the head of that bank. Do you know who that academic was? Just trivia.
No, I don't.
Newton. Sir Isaac Newton was appointed as the first head of the Bank of England, and he's the one that rescued the currency of England. He was appointed by the executive branch. We took a big chunk of that. The most successful country in the world when we were founding was the country that we were rebelling against. We said, all right, let's take some of the really good parts of what they've done and throw out a lot of the bad stuff. Well, since then, we've gathered a lot of the bad stuff back up. We've also gotten rid of a lot more bad stuff. We're a lot better off now than we were back then.
I would say that's an understatement.
The fact that women can vote is a big chunk of that. The Founding Fathers never intended women to vote.
No.
But it doesn't say that in the Constitution, that they never intended it. They just didn't allow it.
Right. It took a constitutional amendment to allow women to vote.
Right.
It's taken constitutional amendments to do a lot of things, like when the Constitution of the United States, people who want to get back to the original Constitution overlook the fact that
the Bill of Rights is kind of important. That wasn't part of the original part.
Yeah, the Bill of Rights isn't in there, and there's this little issue of the fact that the Constitution of the United States authorizes slavery. And I don't think we really want to go back to that either.
No.
But this is the point. In all of this, there's a lot of ill feeling towards President Obama. And
for good cause. He's been kind of mediocre as a president.
I don't know for good cause, but I know that there's a lot of deep-seated emotional ill feeling towards President Obama, just as there was towards George W. Bush.
Yeah.
And matter of fact, their comparable ratings are not very different at this point. And this is the point. We have a tendency to get really, really angry and see evil when the president is not of our philosophy or party. It doesn't make any difference which side of the fence you're on that. That's a true statement.
And, you want me to throw in the psychology of that real fast? If you meet somebody and you disagree about something, you're an intelligent person, the first thing you do is you say, well, I'm going to educate them on this. You start saying, okay, here's what's going on there. And you realize about halfway into the conversation that they're pretty educated on it too. They're pretty intelligent. Your first assumption that they're a good-hearted person, they just don't know what they're talking about. Well, now they know what they're talking about and they still disagree with you. Well, the typical response psychologically to that is they must be evil.
Right. If they understand it and they disagree with me, they must be evil.
Right.
And, man, I don't want to go too deep into this. I could disagree with a lot of the things that President Obama is doing and not get angry at him, but that's me. I can say that there's probably other people who will do a better job, and I can support them. And that's generally the way I approach this. But to move on a little bit.
Yeah. That was a great question, by the way.
The president has de facto become in this, the economist in chief, the same way he is the commander in chief of the armed forces. He has limited powers, or she, hopefully one of these days, has limited powers to do this, but ultimately more power than any other human being on the planet in these issues. And that's the way our Constitution was designed, is to give the executive, the president. Once Congress authorized the president to do something, the execution of that doing is in the hands of the president. And if Congress doesn't want the president, for instance, setting immigration policy and determining enforcement, all they have to do is repeal the bill that gave it to him.
Yeah, all they have to do is write the regulations themselves.
They could.
That's technically their job.
That's probably the single largest problem with Obamacare, is they tried to write the regulations themselves.
Right, and that it was done by a
a committee of 538 people.
Right. Well, it was not. There were zero Republican votes on that bill in the House.
So
Senate passed it with some Republicans.
There were only 200 and some people on the committee. and that's the problem. There's so much garbage in there. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. We were going to talk about some other things.
Iran. That comes up next. Yeah. And we'll do some commercials before that. Yeah.
After or before. Well, we'll just do it before, okay? We'll do some commercials right now. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And Lord willing, we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if you'd like to give us a call in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We were going to discuss
Iran. Nuclear thing.
And actually, I'm going to tell you, this is just Jeff. This is Jeff speaking. And this is my take on this is I ain't smart enough and I don't have enough information, frankly, to render an opinion on an unfinished negotiation.
It hasn't been a very public negotiation.
Even though, well, there have been a tremendous amount of information released on it in the last few days. The one thing I got to say is about that, from a political, socio-political point of view, is we either negotiate something that the Iranians will accept,
or they continue to do what they're doing already.
The alternative is to invade Iran, which is a very big, very powerful, very easily defended country. I don't think we're interested in invading them. I don't think that...
there may be some people interested, but there's no way that the political will exists in the country to invade Iran. Preemptively invade Iran because they might get nuclear weapons. It's not going to happen.
Again, and as a result, a negotiated settlement that they will agree to is better than nothing. And now let me go on from there. That's totally beside the issue. The issue that we look at and I think it's very important, is what effect is this likely to have on an ongoing basis on investment portfolios? And the answer is pretty simple on this one. If we, by the end of this year, by the middle of the year, have an agreement with Iran to start relaxing sanctions, there will be a lot more oil come onto the market yep. than there is today. And the Saudis have expressed a sincere interest in pushing the price of oil lower because of that. Why? Because they recognize if they get oil down in the 20-something per barrel range, it will effectively be an economic sanction against Iran because they won't be able to sell the oil for what it costs to get them out of the ground, it out of the ground, which means they will lose money on every barrel of oil they sell, which means that the price of oil is going to continue to come down. Deflation is still going to be a threat. Economic growth in the United States will probably be higher, and interest rates will probably come up later.
This is a key here, and when we look
if we have a deal with Iran,
right? If we look at the most effective means that the United States has of removing, without force, governments in the world, the most effective means we have is with free trade. If you look at our relationship with China today versus what it was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, even, the reason why we can have businesses set up in China, we can look over at China and not expect them to invade at any moment, is because we're trading with them. They own a huge amount of our debt. If they invaded us, we would never pay them back. And vice versa, we have a bunch of their debt that if we invaded them, they would never pay us back. It doesn't make sense. So if we look at what happened with the fall of the Soviet Union, when we started bringing in all the trade that we could, the more trade we have with people, the more communications we have with them, the more likely they are to bring their thought processes around to our way of thinking. And the opposite is also true. What's happening in Russia now happened because as Putin took more and more control, he limited the influences of the United States' trade in Russia. And then our response to their bad activity was to stop trade even further with Europe and America no longer trading with Russia in a great number of things. That is, at best, a temporary solution. If you truly isolate a country that has a religious or extremely almost cult-like following for a leader, if you look at North Korea, if you look at Iran, our isolation of them makes the leadership more powerful, not less. The more we can show the people of a country a more free and open way of life with more luxuries, more conveniences, better ways of doing things, better educations, the more likely that their people start thinking a lot more like our people. Yeah. If we forever say we've got sanctions on Iran, we're putting sanctions on all the people of Iran, not just the leadership, which makes the people that agree with us less powerful than the people that disagree with us in their own countries. This is true no matter what country we're talking about, and I'll include Israel in that. If we have good relations with Israel, we have open trade, we have great movement back and forth, and all of this is not some kind of a hidden agreement with the leadership in Iran. They have broken international law, ethical law, moral law. They took our embassy. They captured people that were supposed to be immune from that. The reason for diplomacy is to prevent war, and they went to the thing that would prevent war and captured it. There's a lot of problems with the leadership in Iran. There's a lot of problems with the leadership of the Islamic State. They're kind of fundamentalists in two different parties of Islam, and they recognize that. However, if you look at the secular people in Iran, they are almost powerless because they have no they have no money, no lucre. If they could trade with us and make a profit, their voices would get louder. They don't want to go to war with Israel. They can't say that. They don't want to launch nukes on Israel. They can't say that because anybody that's rational, that actually has information available on the world stage, knows that if Iran were to launch a nuclear missile at Israel, Israel would launch back and so would we. There would be no Iran.
One of the very small items in here, but it's significant. The Israelis currently are known to have at least 3 nuclear-capable submarines that operate all the time. In other words, at least they try to keep 2 of them out in the ocean someplace at all times. And believe me, the Iranians do not have the capability of knowing where they are. And yes, what they have is not ICBMs, although they're developing an ICBM. They have cruise missiles. But the cruise missiles that those submarines are capable of launching with nuclear weapons
can hit anywhere in Iran.
Are positioned. I'm guessing they probably sail around to the Indian Ocean or someplace where they're fairly close to Iran. But the point is that there's a lot of complexity here, and very frankly, getting somebody to agree to slow down the Iranians and negotiate and allow inspectors in is probably better than a steady escalation. But that's, again, beside the point. That's not my decision to make. We elect the President of the United States, and we've elected this one twice as a people, to set our foreign policy.
There are some that would say he's not my president, and a lot of them are people that I am positive, swore an oath to the Constitution, he better be their president.
If you're a citizen of the United States, then he's your president, whether you like
it or
not.
Even if you disagree with him, and simply we disagree with him quite a lot.
Simply because the Constitution says so, and I'm loyal to the Constitution. I took that oath. But here's the issue. From our perspective, I am not smart enough to see what's going to happen 15 years from now. Well, to some degree I am, but...
smart or can see 15 years in the future?
I have some idea what's likely to happen 15 years in the future, but this is the point.
Well, when you look at the stars, you can tell where the stars are going
to
be in 15 years.
From an economics point of view, what this tells me is that we're moving towards an agreement with Iran, and the Europeans are going the same way. It's not like we're all by ourselves out here. And that means that there's going to be more oil on the market later this year than there is today. And there's already too much oil on the market for the people who want to buy it. And the reason American companies keep pumping oil out of the ground is because they owe money. Well, the Iranians also owe money, and they really need to export their oil. And they're probably willing to come down into the $20 range to export it just to get the money flowing into the country. What that means is the price of oil... From a very practical point of view, this is an investment show or program. From a very practical point of view, it's actually very simple. The price of oil is low. It's probably going to go lower, and it's probably going to stay there for a relatively long period of time, not forever. And that means that if you're budgeting or if you're looking at the economy or you're looking at what's going on in an investment portfolio, those are all positives for that in the long run. And that's what we invest for, is the long run. Otherwise, it's not investing. So that's really what the agreement means to us right now.
Yeah, I'll take another step back and look at something. Because right now, most of what I'm hearing about from our clients and the people around is the bad idea of allowing this decision to go forward as if the status quo is better. And I have to remind people what the status quo is. They're developing nukes right now. They're doing it. We're not able to stop them unless we invade. There's nothing that we have done up to this point that's preventing them. They are willing to come to the table and sign a paper that says that they're not going to develop nukes.
And allow us to inspect it.
That doesn't sound like a bad thing. Now, from the perspective of the Israelis, it looks like we're endorsing their nuclear research. We're not. In fact, if we were, then we wouldn't be putting inspectors out there. Right now, we cannot inspect. There is no endorsement. There is no lack of endorsement. We are totally against everything that they're doing, and it's not working. If we continue to do something that doesn't work and think that it will, that's a form of insanity. We have to figure out a different approach with Iran, because what we're doing right now is the surest way for them to get a nuclear weapon.
One of the things, by the way, in this agreement, and we're not making ourselves excessively popular here, I'm sure.
No, we're not.
One of the things in the agreement is they've got a large quantity of fissile fuel that is at the level where it could be made into a nuclear weapon right now.
They have it.
Now, it would be a big nuclear weapon, and they wanted to continue.
By big, we mean it's not very portable.
Right. They wanted to continue that process.
Which further enrichment.
Put it into, so they could make it into a smaller one, which they have the capability of doing. And very frankly, in about a year, year and a half on the outside, they could have a nuclear weapon. Now, if we can convince them at this point, and this is what they've just agreed to do informally, it'll be this summer before they formalize the agreement. If we can agree to have them turn over this huge quantity of nuclear-capable, nuclear-weapon-level fuel to a third party, which was originally going to be Russia, but I don't think Russia's...
We don't trust
Russia.
Them very much right now.
And put it away someplace where they can't get to it, or their alternative is, under inspection, to dilute the fuel back down to nuclear levels that are appropriate for reactors. Man, is that a heck of a step in the right direction? Yes, in 15, 10 or 15 years, depending on how the agreement works out, if they have shown good behavior for the next 10 to 15 years, then those sanctions get... The inspections and so on get pulled back. Man, but right now we're at 15 months from a nuclear weapon.
And there's nothing that we're doing currently except for this negotiation that would prevent it.
And I just can't imagine that the United States is going to be willing to go in and attempt to bomb.
We've done that before.
Iran into submission.
We bombed reactors in Iran. We did. Israel did, two different times. We went in and... Well, we, I'm sure, had a lot of satellite technology that was being used by the Israelis. So when I say we did, it was with our complete concurrence. The Israelis knew where to go, and it wasn't based on human intelligence.
Got it. Okay,
it
was that's the we
signals.
You're talking about, right.
So we went in and bombed on two separate occasions reactors in Iran. Iran learned from that and spread them all over the place.
Yeah.
They're underground. They don't have big domes sticking up. They're everywhere. We would have to bomb Iran as a country into complete submission. And I know some of our listeners say, well, why don't we do that?
We don't have the capability, for starters, using nuclear weapons.
And if we did, it would mean that Russia would be allowed to do the same to wherever they want.
Yeah, and again, Iran is big. It is industrialized. It is mountainous. You go look on
there
a...
There are forests.
Yeah,
there
go,
are
go,
mountains.
Yeah,
this is not Iraq. This is not Saudi Arabia. It is hard to find stuff.
And
in either of those countries, it's a lot harder in Iran.
Look on a map and look at the size of Afghanistan, where we've had limited success. And look at the size of Iran. Look at the size of Iraq, which is a big chunk of it is desert. And then go back and look at Iran, a big chunk of which is not desert. And you realize this is a big country.
They have four seasons there. This is not like desert only.
Yeah, and this is a big country. Very frankly, you could literally, in my opinion, in the opinion of a lot of generals, you could take the entire economy of the United States, turn it to a war footing, attempt to invade Iran. And maybe after 15 years and many, many millions of people dead on our side, we might be temporarily successful.
Yeah,
and then we'd get kicked back out again.
Right. This is not a secular government. It isn't like you go in and you remove Saddam Hussein and another government goes in. This is a religious government where to remove the head of state is a direct attack against the entire religion of the people. That means that they would all continue to fight forever.
Yeah, and I just...
Even if you look back at Roman history, you see that the Romans tried to avoid that completely as well.
Looking at all the possible ways of approaching this, I think quite probably this is the best of them, unless somebody comes up with a better one.
It's still not
great. By the way, Prime Minister Netanyahu, in his speech to Congress, which I read, did not propose an alternative to this deal. He simply said, it's bad. Well, what's a good one? And somebody come up with a better one, I'll probably be the first to support it. Anyway, we got to do commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And if this is Saturday, April 4th, you can contact us on the other side, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
We'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I keep getting the bumper music mixed up, but that's life. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. I've got some stories here, too. You want me to hit one?
Okay.
New single-family home sales rose 7.8% in February. Why is that a big deal? A lot of what we report and what is reported by the media in general are lagging indicators, things like unemployment figures or jobless rates or who's being hired or not hired. That's an indication of what's already happened in the economy. Well, businesses don't hire people when they're losing money. They hire people when they're making money, but only after they've been making money for a bit. So it's a way of measuring the past by looking at the unemployment figures going backwards. Going forwards, we want to see housing sales and housing starts. And in February, both of those are up. Single-family housing sales were way up. Single-family housing starts were up. These are indicators of what's happening in the future. That money gets put into the economy very quickly. When a house is being built, that's the best, but they're still really slow there, which means that in our expansion, we have a lot of leeway. We have a lot of houses that are households that are waiting for houses. So when we see a number like a 7.8% increase, that is huge. That is a massive uptick in the home sales. And so now I've said my story and on to your story.
Well, there's a couple of things. One, there's a how to choose a financial advisor in Barron's today, Gene Epstein. It's a review of a book. It's a review of several books, actually, and there's some very, very good things that it has to say in there, and basically he comes down on the same thing that we have, so obviously he's brilliant, which is hiring a fiduciary investment manager who is fee-only. But here's the key. Is willing to put in writing and give you a statement in writing, I will act as your fiduciary at all times, over his signature. And interestingly enough, you will find that at that point, somebody who dances around the word fiduciary and says,
I'm a fiduciary.
The issue is, I will act as a fiduciary for you or as your fiduciary at all times, in writing and give it to you. By the way, we do. It's called our Form ADV. We can state this.
Right.
Yeah.
There are firms out there that are fiduciary and retail.
But they won't say in all times.
No. What they'll do is say, yes, absolutely, I'm a fiduciary. And then they switch over to another role where they're selling you something. Mm-hmm. And they don't necessarily, they're supposed to tell you when that happens, but they don't. And then there's the people that say they're fiduciaries and aren't. They're not going to put it in writing.
Yeah. And then the second article that came up in Barron's this week, and we're almost out of time, so I'm rushing through this, is the new thing is liquid alts.
Oh, boy.
Anytime that somebody is trying to put you in what's called an alternative investment, run, don't walk to the nearest exit, alternative investments are investments that historically have not traded on the open market, so they have appeared to have price stability. That is their universal law. Alternative investment funds that are liquid alternatives, I have tracked personally and looked at and found out that they universally, without exception, underperform a conservative allocation fund. The purpose in the alts is to stabilize the portfolio, a good, inexpensive conservative allocation fund. The average one...
We're talking about over a longer period of time.
But even in the shorter period of time, they have displayed, many of them have displayed anything but the characteristics that they supposedly were going, because as soon as they become liquid, they're technically no longer an alternative investment. And as a result, people can jump in and out of them, and that causes the price to go up and down, which is the reason that they were there to begin with. So a couple of things to watch out for is alternative investments, and basically be aware of the fact that if you think your advisor is a fiduciary, get him to put it in writing. Well, you've been listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, or not, as the case may be.
I haven't been listening.
For the last 2 hours, and we are both here and there. During the week, we operate out of Salado, and we have an investment advisory firm, and we certainly look forward to your input. And you can give us a call there. We have voicemail on the weekend, of course, but during the week, we have live people answer the phone, and we do take your calls. 947-1111, or
you can also reach that voicemail toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can reach us by email directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There you'll see our philosophy, our bios. You'll get to see our ugly mugs. You'll get to see the wonderful people that we work with in our office. And you'll also get to listen to podcasts of this radio program going back ad nauseum. Please take your nausea medication beforehand, as well as any type of psychoactive substances that have been prescribed for you, because your insanity levels may rise.